Liz Corey.
And I'm Katie King.
And this is
True Crime New England.
What's up, everybody?
Hello, welcome back.
How is it going, Katie?
It's going.
Oh, yep, that's it. Okay, yeah. It is going. Yeah. You know, I similarly am just going. Yeah, I'm doing it, doing it. On another positive note,
yeah,
this marks 5 episodes where we've been counting the swear jar.
Yes, we're about halfway there. We decided on our 10 episode chunks for each.
Yeah. Yep. So Katie has been doing some great stuff finding what should be our first charity to donate to. So Katie, you tell us what you got.
So I found this article. Actually, it was in response to a missing persons poster we put on our Instagram out of a girl in, I believe it was Massachusetts. And they found her. They found her safely, but she was maybe hours away from being sent down to Miami for human trafficking.
Right.
So they found her. It was good. They actually found 2 other girls as well.
Oh, wow.
That was another great job done by Unsolved Rhode Island. I know we mentioned them before.
Lauren at Unsolved Rhode Island.
Yes.
Love her. She's fantastic.
She fucking rocks.
She does a lot of great work.
Speaking of great work, when I was reading about human trafficking, it's been a major increase, especially in the state of New Hampshire, which a lot of people don't think of New Hampshire as a big hotspot for human trafficking. You think of it as more cities.
Right.
But Manchester, New Hampshire is a pretty big area. Actually, there have been human trafficking survivors flagged in all counties of New Hampshire, and it's only getting worse.
Yeah.
So in response to this, there is a new organization. They actually start taking referrals in March. Wow. It's called Bridget's House of Hope. So we decided that they, because they're just starting, basically, they are a very worthy cause of our F-word money.
Yes.
The name Bridget is actually named after the founder's great-great-grandmother, and it's also named after Saint Bridget of Ireland. She was born into slavery, and she's the patron saint of those in captivity.
Oh.
Which is perfect.
Yeah.
This is actually the first setting in New Hampshire of its kind that specifically houses human trafficking survivors.
Okay.
A lot of human trafficking survivors are given drugs to subdue them, to make them easier to traffic.
Right.
A lot of them turn to drugs as a coping mechanism. So
a
lot of places that agree to shelter these victims don't shelter them if they are struggling with drug use.
Right.
Bridget's House of Hope does.
That's wonderful.
So that's amazing. They are going to be sheltering 6 to 8 women at a time. They will provide them with food, security, mental health treatment, rehabilitation, job training, and education.
Wow.
80% of human trafficking survivors end up being re-trafficked as a direct result of not having a safe place to go. So this is such an important cause.
Yes.
This is incredible.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So they start taking referrals in March. You can find their Instagram, Bridget's New Hampshire.
Yeah.
You can go to their website, bridgidshouseofhope.org. The name Bridget is spelled B-R-I-G-I-D, which is the Gaelic spelling, the Irish spelling. And you can learn more or make a donation yourself.
Yes, please. These small, just starting out charities need these donations more than anyone.
Especially this one, because they were set to start around 2020 and then COVID hit and really screwed them over.
I'm sure.
So they're finally starting to open.
That's great.
Yeah. And COVID has only made human trafficking more prevalent.
Yeah.
So this is such an important cause, and we are very excited to be giving them some F-word money. yeah, and then when we get to our 10 episodes, we'll tell you guys how much we raised for them.
And I don't know the total so far off the top of my head, but I can tell you that after 3 episodes, we had more than $25. So, and the episode we had that came up before this, episode 34, we swore a lot.
I know. I have to go in and we have to like tally how many, but there's going to be a lot.
At least $10 from that one alone. So
yeah. So I think the swear jar is such a good idea.
It is.
Thank you, Janice, again for the idea.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. So I feel like if we could turn our language habit into a little something good for good causes.
Yes. And that is a wonderful cause.
Yeah.
I'm glad you found it. And, their Instagram is beautiful. They do a great job. And again, thank you, Lauren from Unsolved RI, for helping us find that, even if it was indirectly.
Yeah.
So that's awesome. I think that's great.
Hell yeah.
I think it's a great thing. And it's even better when like what we do for our show, it goes to such a good cause. I'm so excited.
Hell yeah.
I cannot wait to see how much money we raise.
It's going to be a lot. Even if it was like $5, like that makes a huge difference.
Yes,
but the fact that it's three episodes that we know for sure, and it's already over $25, like that's a lot.
And I want to say, breaking it down between you and I, it's mostly me, unsurprisingly, and that's okay.
But it's all right.
It's all right, because it goes, in the end, it goes to a good cause.
Yeah.
Like before, you know, this one will be doing Bridget's House of Hope, but if you have other charities that you guys think we should donate to, you let us know, please.
Yeah, true.
We love charity, and in these times of pandemic and just everything going on, it's needed more than ever.
For sure.
We're happy to do, we have the means to do things like that, so we're happy to do it. So that's amazing. Anyway, today's case, I don't know what it is up with us lately, but it's unsolved again.
Yeah.
We're really on a kick.
And that just makes it all the more sad, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, we wanted to just kind of start the episode with some positive things, because this case today is especially brutal.
It really is.
Just the manner of death is very brutal, and it might be hard to listen to just because it's really, it's awful.
It's very brutal. So definite trigger warning here.
For sure.
I don't even know what, like, not a specific thing. It's just very gory.
Disturbing and graphic.
Yeah.
Murder.
Yeah. It's awful.
So if that's not something you want to have to listen to, not a problem.
We get it.
We'll see you next week.
Goodbye. But it is definitely worth listening to in the sense that this woman needs justice.
The fact that it's a cold case, like, we had to talk about it.
It's insane.
I know.
So, without further ado, today we will be covering the case of the murder of Leah Ulbrich. All right. Our sources, let's go over them. Katie, please start.
I found a great article from Medium.com. I found two separate articles from the Hartford Courant, which seems to be a common source from Connecticut.
Yep.
Go there. The unresolved murder thread on Reddit, portal.ct.gov for Connecticut cold cases. That's how I found this case. Connecticut has a deck of cards for cold cases to try to get them out there. And then Web Sleuths.
Of course.
They're always a great one.
They are. They really are. I had Medium.com as well. I love Medium.com.
Phenomenal.
They have everything. It's amazing. That the article I had was written by a woman named Jen Baxter. I'm sure you probably have the same one.
I sure do.
I also had the Unresolved Mysteries Reddit thread, something I scour every night when I'm laying in bed, truly. So I love that thread. I also had something from DonnaGore.com. She's an author or an investigator who did a lot of research around this case.
Oh, cool.
The Hartford Courant, of course. And a website called Imagine Publicity.
Ooh.
Yeah, some interesting stuff. So, again, this case, brutal. Absolutely terrible. Let's start with talking about Leah Ulbrich. Gorgeous. I love her pictures. We have a cute picture of her and her kids on our website.
Mm-hmm.
So cute. She was just a typical mom and young mom in the 90s, really. So Leah Baskin was born on January 18th of 1971, and unfortunately she led a short and kind of troubled life.
Mm-hmm.
She loved to write poetry, and she was a very talented artist, and she was described by her friends and family as very creative and a very expressive person. And in the 1980s, Leah had spent her teenage years experimenting with hard drugs. Luckily, she managed to recover after going to rehab, and this is when she met her husband, Bob Ulbrich, which is where she got the last name Ulbrich, of course. Together, Bob and Leah had two children, Ryan and Abriella. Unfortunately, their marriage didn't last very long, which is unfortunate, not only for them, but for the kids, because that's always tough on children when their parents get divorced.
For sure.
Especially it seems like her kids were pretty young. So that's a big bummer. In 1991 is when their marriage kind of fell apart. It had only been 2 years. And this is kind of when Leah found herself back in the throes of drug abuse.
Yeah. She actually escalated her drug use at this point when she got caught up with a crowd that used cocaine. Her behavior escalated, and then in 1993, she actually lost custody of her two kids. Police had found drugs and drug paraphernalia in her home, and they also described her living conditions as squalid. When her ex-husband and her mother were granted joint custody, this was very upsetting to Leah, and this was also a huge factor in her worsening addiction to drugs because she continued to turn to drugs as a coping mechanism.
Right. She was just so upset about not having her children anymore. And, you know, it's hard, a hard thing to do to split custody or see your husband, your ex-husband, and your mom split custody and you only have certain, like, visitation. That's tough.
It's awful.
So I would understand why she would want to turn to drugs. Like, that was her comfort. And it's sad that that was her comfort. Because that's, as we know, just a really awful thing to turn to.
Yeah.
But addiction is horrible. It's strong.
It's awful. In the summer of 1995, Leah had actually voluntarily checked herself into a drug rehabilitation program in Middleton, Connecticut. She actually ended up graduating a couple months before the incident that we'll talk about.
Mm-hmm.
She had been attending regular Narcotics Anonymous meetings. She moved into a halfway house, mm-hmm. and she was also working on earning her GED. She was very determined to turn her life around, get her kids back.
Yeah.
She had just hit one full year of sobriety.
Wow.
She had always been described as caring for people very deeply.
Yeah.
And so because of this, she had been throwing around the idea of becoming a nurse and going to nursing school. So she seemed like this would be a good time to get her affairs in order, and then maybe she would go and become a nurse.
Right.
Like she'd always wanted, and kind of tossed the idea around.
And I think that's a great idea. I mean, maybe I'm biased, but, you know, being a nurse is pretty awesome. So I think it's really cool that she even had that idea, and I think that's a great way to motivate yourself, especially when you have a goal. And good on her for getting her GED. That's no small feat.
Mm-hmm.
So that's awesome that she was able to do that. And getting to a halfway house, a year clean, that's fantastic. I hope people understand how hard that is. A year is such a long time, you know, and just continuing on with that is hard. That's a hard thing to do. So good on her. But for some reason, Leah had suddenly and abruptly walked away from her halfway house about 2 weeks before this incident.
Mm-hmm.
And her parents were so scared. I'm sure even her ex-husband was worried, like, what had happened. And they definitely feared that she had possibly relapsed with her drug addiction, which even the thought alone is devastating just for her dreams and her goals and wanting to get her kids back. That's hard. That's real hard. I think when we, you know, when we're about to talk about what happened, I think it's probably a fair assumption that she did fall back into her drug addiction, just given the circumstances of what happened.
For
sure. Unfortunate.
She was 24 years old at this time. This puts us at Sunday, October 29th, 1995, at about 4:45 in the morning. Leah was seen by a witness in the passenger seat of a car with an unidentified male in the driver's seat. Several witnesses actually saw them. They were parked near the intersection of Locust and East Elliott Streets in Hartford, Connecticut. This was near the UPS facility. This area is kind of the industrial section of Hartford.
Mm-hmm.
So you would think on a Sunday at 4:45 in the morning, not a lot of people would be awake.
Right.
But there were some people kind of roaming around to witness this. So someone described Leah and the man getting into an argument, they're just kind of yelling at each other, and then the fight turned physical.
Yeah. It seemed that, you know, that witnessed it could identify the man, but they could identify Leah. And they weren't even really sure what kind of car it was. They said, you know, the speculation was that it was like a 1990s model of a Nissan Maxima or Altima and was either black, brown, or blue. That doesn't really, you know, narrow things down very easily. It does a little, but not very much.
Right.
Another thing that one witness noticed was that in the vehicle, there was a temporary license tag in the back rear window. Now, this was a little more helpful because not not a lot of cars had that. At least it narrowed it down more. Mm-hmm. And actually, the police ended up going for the entire state of Connecticut, looking and seeing what cars had that in their records of having that temporary license tag in their back rear window. And even that didn't help, unfortunately. No. So like you said, Katie, people heard and saw the fighting. Why was Leah with this man at 4 a.m? We don't know. It was speculated that she had turned to sex work for her possible re-addiction to drugs. And unfortunately, Locust Street, this area, was known for local sex work, like a hub for mm-hmm. sex work. So it's theorized that this man was probably a John or someone paying for sex work. Definitely possible. Seems like it. That kind of sets the scene of what was going on. There was a man named Bill Fleming who was a delivery driver. I wrote for our friends at the Hartford Courant. And he was driving down Locust Street when he noticed the car. And when he passed the car, he noticed that whoever the driver was, the man, hit Leah. And he started, you know, he was driving away and he was like, wait, what? Did I just see that? And so he immediately turned around. He also heard Leah screaming for help, which is horrifying. 4 a.m. Can you imagine hearing that?
And not a good part of town either.
No. I bet it's probably something that's heard kind of often.
Mm-hmm. When Bill made the U-turn to see if he could help, mm-hmm. he saw the driver of the car rev the engine and take off.
Ugh.
But the thing about this was, and Bill is looking at the car and he's not really sure what he's seeing.
Yeah.
And it's kind of coming to him. It's dark out. It's early in the morning. He's working so early.
Right.
He just heard screaming. His adrenaline's going. He's looking at this car driving away from him. And he notices that Leah is hanging from the passenger side of the car.
Ugh.
Being dragged as this guy is driving away.
Yeah. He's speeding at this point.
He's hauling ass. Bill said he tried to follow this guy mm-hmm. to follow the car, and they started to reach speeds of 60 miles per hour. So Bill is in his work truck delivering papers or doing something.
Right.
He has to slow down and stop, and he had to call for help. He's like, I can't follow this guy. He's going over 60 miles an hour.
It wasn't safe for him to follow.
Right.
Which is scary, because like you said, it's in an industrial area.
Right.
Buildings and businesses, like, I think any of us could probably say the speed limit was probably a lot less than 60 miles per hour.
No, we're talking 25, 30. 35 at best.
Yeah. So that's a huge jump.
Really bad.
And so, you know, can you imagine being Bill? It's 4 a.m, he's driving, and you see this woman hanging. They think that she got wrapped up in the, like, in the seatbelt, mm-hmm. her arm, and just hanging out of the door, being dragged along the pavement.
And she's still screaming.
And she's screaming. Oh, it's so terrifying. Just the visuals I imagined in my head were so disturbing. This poor woman. Awful stuff. And so, of course, Bill called the police, and that was around 4:50 a.m. when he had lost sight of the car, which headed down East Elliott Street, which was in the direction of Weathersfield Avenue. Now, we know that this was the path the car took because as Leah was being dragged behind this car, obviously there was a lot of blood being left behind. She had a whole trail of blood. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. And you can see pictures of like the detectives showing, you know, some of it. And it's just like, oh, it's so sad.
Yeah, it's actually up on our website.
Yeah, it's awful.
A lot of the Polaroids that they took and a lot of the case information is still closed to the public due to its graphic nature.
Right.
But we were able to find a less graphic picture just to show the path in which she was dragged, essentially.
Yeah. So as the car turned onto Weathersfield Avenue, this is where several witnesses saw the horrifying scene and I'm sure heard Leah screaming. Mm-hmm. I think at first maybe he didn't know he was dragging Leah's body. Maybe. But he knew after a little bit. And he definitely knew by the time her body fell off, 4 miles after he had begun the drive.
I think he was completely aware when the Hartford Courant driver was chasing him and he sped up.
Right.
Oh, she's screaming. She's screaming.
God.
So whoever this guy is fully aware.
Yeah. And so the convenient part is that an officer, Martin Burke, saw the unidentified man's car, his headlights coming toward him, in which he immediately tried to, you know, he turned around, tried to pull him over. And then the man had already sped out of view and left a trail of blood falling behind it. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
It's 4:50 in the morning. And you're just like beat cop on the streets, la la la, and you see that and something being dragged. At this point, it wasn't really a body.
No.
It wasn't really a body.
The officer is trying to pull this guy over and he speeds out of sight. Mm-hmm. So the officer is left to follow the blood trail onto Jordan Lane, and this is where he discovered what was left of Leah's body. She had been dragged for over 4.5 miles from the industrial South Meadows of Hartford to the southern edge of Goodwin Park in Wethersfield. She had been torn to pieces.
Literally torn to pieces.
They ended up having to section off multiple crime scenes along Jordan Lane.
Ugh.
Several residents who lived on Jordan Lane reported hearing Leah screaming, which means that she was alive for most of what had happened.
Can you imagine?
Hearing this and doing the research, I thought, okay, maybe she'd go for a little bit before she'd hopefully pass out.
Right.
No.
Doesn't sound like it. Especially if they're hearing her scream on Jordan Lane.
Which is where she was found.
Oh,
that's right there.
Yep. She was torn to pieces.
They were only able to identify her at first from her tattoos.
Yeah. So she had the word Aussie on her ankle, which I saw a picture of, and a pair of theater masks on her shoulder. So she was quite literally torn up, but enough where you could see those identifying marks. Mm-hmm. That is just so disturbing to me. And the medical examiner, not that there really needed to be an autopsy done, I'm sure we could all figure out how she died, but they determined that Leah's cause of death would be most obviously blunt force trauma to her entire body. Entire body.
Her shoes had been found on Locust Street, which is where the incident first began. Mm. Her jacket was nearby, and because of the trail of blood for 4.5 miles, this case is still regarded as the largest crime scene in Connecticut state history.
Which is makes sense. That's a long, long, long drive. Oh my God. I'm just thinking, like, I'm trying to think, 4 miles, okay. Where would I be in I'm like, that must have felt like forever.
Mm-hmm.
This poor woman. And, you know, it's been many years, and there's still no answer, which is fucked. Completely, truly fucked. The investigation is frustrating as well.
Yep.
Because, again, there's no answers. There's no answers. So, despite there being plenty of witnesses to her murder, not only just hearing it, but witnessing it physically with their eyeballs, none of them could accurately identify who her killer was. Most of the witnesses described a man who appeared to be either white or Hispanic, but with a light complexion. He had a slender build and dark hair that was slicked back. He looked as if he was in his late 20s and was clean shaven, which is surprising that they got all this from just looking in the car.
Yeah.
But you'd think they would have found him immediately, right? I feel like they would have. Of course, investigators interviewed Leah's ex-husband, her ex-boyfriends, her friends, mm-hmm. and they ultimately determined that it was none of them. So they were in the clear. And of course, like we said, nobody could truly identify the car.
Right.
Let alone the color of it, the make and the model. They just had the general, like, oh, maybe it was a 1990s-ish Nissan, and it was either blue, black, or brown. Oh.
It sucks because it's 4:45 in the morning.
Right.
It's dark outside.
Right.
And, you know, this car is traveling at high rates of speed through an industrial area, dragging somebody. Like, if you see that go by you, it's going to take a little bit to process what's going on.
Yeah.
Let alone get the plate number.
Right.
The make and the model, the description of the guy, what's going on.
Right.
So it really is awful because I feel like if this had happened in broad daylight, you would have been able to determine what the car looked like.
Oh, for sure. Oh, for sure. They wanted to talk to all the witnesses, understandably. Yeah. Except they couldn't get a hold of one. And it was one witness they thought maybe had the most answers, but they could not get a hold of her. It was ridiculous. You would think after seeing the news stories and after seeing that, that you'd want to come forward.
And it's really infuriating too, because the one witness that they can't get a hold of, she actually called 911.
Yeah.
She used a phone booth on the corner of Weathersford Avenue and Elliott Street, and she called 911 to report a woman was being dragged by a car. She actually hung up the phone before she could provide any more details, any more information, and authorities are still trying to figure out who she is.
Right. I wonder if she was a sex worker herself.
Yeah.
I just thought of that. That might be why she didn't want anyone to know who she was, which is, I understand that, but this woman's life was lost. Yeah. And it could have really helped to know what this woman had seen. She didn't give any more details. She just hung up the phone. So that's so sad.
Right.
Oh my God. And in order to try and pinpoint the perpetrator, investigators actually asked like auto repair shops nearby.
Yeah, that's right.
I thought this was so smart, to report any customers who came in specifically looking for like a passenger side seatbelt repair. Cause the theory was that maybe Leah got her arm stuck in the seatbelt. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's possible that the seatbelt would be damaged if she had been dragged for 4 miles via the seatbelt. It probably broke in half. Like, how did she finally fall out, you know?
Right.
So that's a good investigative point. Like, hey, guys, mechanics, take a look. Let us know.
That was crazy, too, with the car. They had determined that the car had most likely sustained damage to the front passenger side door as well as the right fender. So maybe someone would notice a car with that kind of specific damage and call it in.
Right.
So the police and investigators are really appealing to the public. Like, hello, this is the largest crime scene in Connecticut state history.
Right.
This is tragic. Everybody in the area heard her screaming.
Right.
This is a brutal, brutal, brutal murder.
Yeah.
Maybe if somebody saw something, you can pick up the phone and call us.
Right.
But, and you know what? I give them props because they really went all out to solve this. They really,
they truly did. Yeah. And I mean, I think, again, asking repair, auto repair men, garages, even asking friends or anyone who said, oh, do you have a friend who drives a Nissan and you notice all of a sudden that they're not driving that car anymore or their car is damaged, call it into the police. Nobody did.
Yeah.
Nobody did. Leah's father, Robert Baskin, I mean, come on, they were devastated, just devastated. And he made an appeal for help in December of 1995, so just a month and a half or so after Leah was murdered. And he said he was haunted by how much Leah must have suffered and that he wanted to make sure her murderer paid for what he had done, which absolutely agree. She must have suffered. That was not a quick, painless death.
No.
That was horrid.
I know.
As evidenced, of course, by her screaming. So her poor dad, you know, making this appeal and saying, come on, someone's got to know something. It didn't. Nothing came forward until a small, small, small lead in the case in March of 1996. It was very small. And it was done thanks to forensic testing on Leah's clothes at the time of her murder. What it showed was there was metallic blue paint chips all over her clothes, which indicated that the car she was dragged from must have been blue.
Mm-hmm.
Which honestly, when I heard that they were going between blue, black, and brown, I was like, okay, it was probably black or brown because those are very similar.
Mm-hmm.
But it was blue, I guess. Surprising. But that kind of narrowed it down a little bit. A few weeks after the paint chip discovery, the police that were working her case announced that they had a potential suspect. Except they said they were nowhere near to making an arrest, and they had submitted other things for forensic testing, but that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing much. Nothing much.
Even though they withheld the name of this potential suspect, the media actually learned that this person was a 24-year-old who had been arrested on multiple counts of kidnapping and attempted sexual assault charges just several months after Leah was killed.
Oh, shit.
Detectives working on Leah's case became interested in this man after several women claimed he had picked them up in Hartford and driven them to secluded areas of East Hartford, where he then assaulted them and forced them out of his car.
Ugh.
So this sounds very similar to the altercation between this man and Leah, where they got into a fight and maybe he was forcing her out of the car and tried to drive away. Maybe she was trying to get out of the car by herself and got stuck.
Right.
I'm wondering, too, if the fight became physical.
Oh, maybe.
He had reached across her, opened up the door, and tried to kick or shove her out.
Yeah.
And then drive off, and she got stuck.
Yeah.
Detectives learned of him and his record, and they got a warrant to search his car. They even submitted several items to the forensic lab for comparison with the evidence they got from the murder scene. He did appear to be a solid suspect, but the test results came back with no match.
Ugh.
The paint as well actually came back with no match, as well as the fiber samples.
That's so annoying.
It's just so, so frustrating.
Yeah.
I feel very bad for her parents.
Me too.
Her dad, in his appeal in December that you talked about, Liz, he told reporters that Leah's seat at the family dinner table had been empty on Thanksgiving while the killer was still free to spend the holiday with his loved ones and roam around as if nothing had happened.
I know. That's so unfair. It's a really good point, too. The killer just was going about his life, knowing that he had taken someone else's so brutally.
Leah's family had said that they believed drugs had been responsible for Leah's death, and Robert feared that the fact that Leah had been an addict caused some people to overlook her death.
Right.
He stated, "I hope they will see that Leah was a real person. I think we all value justice, and whoever did this ought to be punished." Robert ended up serving as chief of staff for the U.S. Representative Sam Gegenson, and he wanted people to remember that no matter what Leah had done in the past, his daughter was still a victim of a horrific crime, and then she deserved justice.
Of course. I couldn't agree more. That's awful.
Yeah.
So in 2002, Hartford police announced that the $20,000 reward that they had for Leah for information had been raised to $50,000, which, I mean, that's a lot of money. A lot of money. And in addition to that, a tip line was set up for people to call in. They really, really hoped that they would get that woman who called in initially to come forward. Spoiler alert, she did not. Also in 2002, at a press conference that was held by investigators, they announced that a cord from an electronic device had been found with Leah's remains. They believe that she had ripped it from the car as she was struggling to stay alive.
Jesus Christ.
I know, isn't that crazy? So this electric cord being ripped from the vehicle led the investigators to believe that maybe the killer had needed some sort of repair on his car to fix this part shortly after the murder. And so, of course, they had a call to action again for mechanics, auto repair shops, to saying, did you have someone shortly after this murder took place that needed an electronic cord fixed in their car? No dice. Nobody came forward, unfortunately. And even to this day, it's still unclear if Leah even knew her killer.
Yeah.
Was it possible that she was doing sex work and that was, you know, her, it was a customer that murdered her? Yeah, definitely possible. Definitely possible.
It just, the manner of how she died, I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy.
No, no. I wouldn't wish that on anyone. That was so, and the fact that she was alive for most of it. She suffered so much, and this killer is walking free.
Going at 60 miles per hour and over.
Yeah.
In 2019, detectives from the Hartford Police Department stated that they were still trying to obtain justice for Leah. They have continued to submit evidence for advanced forensic testing that was unavailable at the time of the murder. But unfortunately, none of the tests have resulted in the identification of the killer, and the case is still cold today.
That's terrible.
Anyone with any information about this case is asked to please contact the Hartford Police Cold Case Unit. Their phone number is 860-548-0606. There is still a $50,000 reward offered for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person responsible.
Man, somebody knows something. Somebody knows something. You know who does know something? The man who killed her. So maybe if you want to clear your fucking conscience, why don't you go ahead and do so? If you're listening to this podcast right now.
Hello, we're going to come find you.
Yeah, why are you listening to this? Weirdo.
And then how about that woman that called 911 and hung up on the operator before she could elaborate? Like, we're looking for you. The police want to talk to you.
You could be so helpful.
And it's so frustrating that the one person that's not coming forward, all the other witnesses, were able to be, you know, interviewed and give their piece and elaborate on their phone calls. She's the one with this perfect angle.
Yes.
Right at the intersection where she called on the phone booth, she would have seen the guy.
Yeah.
Or she would have seen the car at such an angle where she could confirm the color. Mm-hmm. She could confirm what this guy looked like. She could confirm the license plate, even what state it's from.
Right. It could have been not Connecticut.
There was actually speculation that the plate was a New York plate.
Interesting.
One of the witnesses had said that he'd seen that.
Okay.
But yeah, it's just, it's so frustrating.
Oh, that is really, that's just awful.
And she was just 24 and she leaves behind her two children who actually her kids are doing great things in the world.
Yes, they are.
And they would like their mom to get justice.
Of course. Of course. That is, yeah, it's terrible. I can't believe it's still unsolved. I can't believe it.
I know.
So again, if you guys know someone who was in Connecticut, in Hartford around this time, don't be afraid to ask them, hey, did you see this? Remember this crazy thing you may have blocked from your memory because it was so awful? You know, anything helps. Anything. Mm-hmm. So it's just terrible stuff. It really is. It's just so sad. Well, anyway, you guys can follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at truecrimene.
All lowercase.
And you can email us at truecrimene@gmail.com.
And you can also head to our website, truecrimene.com. You can check out our pages, learn more about us, spend time on the website. You can even use our submission tool to send us questions, comments, concerns, cases that you would like for us to cover. Please, if they're in New England, send them our way. If they're not in New England and you want to talk to us about them, that's fine too.
Love that.
If you want to tell us to have a great day, that's fine too.
It's so nice of you guys to do that for us.
If you want to be anonymous, that's fine too. We'd
totally
love to hear from you either way.
Please. It's the wheel that keeps us turning, mm-hmm. I think. So send us whatever you want. Is it your birthday? Happy birthday. Did your mom go to Aruba last week? That is so cool.
Let us know.
Let us know. That's great.
Preferably true crime related, but I mean, we'll talk to you guys.
Hey, we'll talk to you. We'll talk to anyone. But anyway, thank you guys for listening and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Goodbye.